Okay, here's the 8th lecture, 5th London ACC. Today we have an interesting new subject. This interesting new subject which we have is detection of engrams. It's the third actual lecture I've made on the subject. Well, I'm going to tell you about finding truth. Finding truth with an electronic gimmick. That takes a bit of doing. In the first place, electronics are an awful big lie. Electronics tell you that you can't do it, they have to. It's quite amusing. Electronics people tend to rather go up the spout. They look at the little particles going in here and coming out there and going around someplace else and doing a small squirrel cage elsewhere and being condensed and rarefied and contracted. And after a while, why, the hidden particle is the thing and you have nuclear physics. They're trying to concentrate on a hidden particle, a hidden thing. Trying to concentrate on a hidden mass. They say there's a mass, there is no mass. All mass is no mass. After a while, they go up the spout entirely, invent atomic bombs. And the governments all go up the spout and decide to govern by explosion. All because somebody started following a little particle. Went in here and came out there, went around the circle, got rarefied, condensed, extracted, contracted, retracted, and passed by the Atomic Energy Commission. The hidden particle. Now, if you'll just concentrate on the hidden mystery, the hidden unknowingness, the non-observable, non-confrontable nowhere, you'll be just about as sane as the boys were down in Bedlam, I assure you. That's the way to go up the spout. Absolutely sure, certain, guaranteed to wind up in a proper certificate of non-compos mentis. And similarly, you go looking for the hidden particle. The hidden particle. In a problem. You know, it's quite interesting that there is no evidence of innocence. There's no positive evidence of innocence. There's an absence of evidence of guilt in this universe. If you commit the act, you can be found guilty with great positiveness. But if you don't commit the act, and yet can't furnish an elsewhereness satisfactory to all hands, and it's never really entirely satisfactory, they say you had friends or you bought the witnesses. People go right on looking for a hidden particle called guilt. You see that? If you're looking for a hidden particle in a problem, it just never seems to occur to anybody that it might not be there. You know? And this is a brand new, sweeping, scientific fact. That if you can't find it, it might not be there. And someday when you are decorating your skull with gray hairs in attempting to resolve some case and find the button that resolves all buttons, just remember what I've said here. It might not be there. If you can't find it, it might not be there. With what touching faith a Thetan goes on rooting in a pile of garbage for a pearl With what fabulous stick-to-ivity do governments go on rooting for taxes in people who are broke? With what wondrous logic, presence, perspicuity, and sagacity do prosecuting attorneys go on rooting into crime for guilt amongst the innocents? And it never occurs to any of these people, it might not be there. It's quite an amazing thing. If you just consider that for a little while, you'll find yourself snapping off of a great many old, worn searches that have worn your shoes, your mental shoes, very thin. You think of anything you looked for that you were sure was there, that you never found? Now, just get the idea. Well, you know, it might not have been there. Or it might not be there. Now, when we take up detection, bluntly, factually, move right in on the whole subject, we get the first condition which must obtain for a search for anything to be successful. And that is existence of the thing. In order for you to search for something successfully, it is necessary for it to be there. Sounds awfully awkwardly stupid, doesn't it? It's a stupid sort of an argument. All of you probably feel a little bit stupid right this minute, just looking it over. Because that's what stupidity is. The search for something which isn't there and not finding it. After a while, a fellow feels terribly stupid. He should have known in the first place that it wasn't there, he says. But he can't admit being this dumb. So he turns around on his not knowingness and he says, well, I can't be that stupid. Therefore, my own not knowingness, my own stupidity couldn't possibly exist either. So we get the hidden nowhere being totally boundaried on every side by stupidity that nobody will admit. And if nobody owns it and nobody will be responsible for this stupidity, we eventually wind up with nuclear physics and its role in modern diplomacy. I'd rather call it boomacy. Now, this is a matter you must understand. You just have to be able to take a look at it and understand it. Because it'll tell you why the search for the human mind, dead-ended, messed up, fouled up, went up the spout, went on so many zigs and so many zags and so many vzias back through past ages. Somebody would make up his mind something was there and then devote the rest of his life looking for it. Freud made up his mind that there were all sorts of doodle-daddles and thingamabobs and whatnots in the mind. Tremendous machinery and clankingness. There was a censor. There was some sort of a barbaric self of some kind or another. There were ids and egos and things that went boom in the night. And with what enthusiasm he went looking for these things. Now, you want to know what happened to the advance of psychoanalysis? Any subject which is live and still living grows. It grows for a long time after it's first conceived. C- course, if you eventually found the answer, it would stop growing to some degree, but it would still accumulate to itself technology and knowingness and thinkingness. Couldn't help it, because it's alive. But psychoanalysis was born in 1894 and stayed there. All the things that were supposed to be there weren't there, so the lookingness of it dead-ended there. And people from that point on just got more and more stupid, more and more stupid, more and more stupid, more and more stupid. Don't you see? So it couldn't grow up. It could only grow down. And anything that is mentioned in Dianetics or Scientology that isn't there in fact, and yet which continues to be searched for, will just make the searcher or Dianetics and Scientology that much more stupid. To find something, there has to be something there. Very fascinating as a broad principle and far too simple to grasp easily. Now, across all of the years of research and investigation in the field of the mind, we have numerous examples of things that weren't there, that people thought were there, and things which could be blamed for man's ills or all of man's ills. We have a recent superstition which you do not yet regard entirely, not even in Dianetics and Scientology at this stage, do not yet know is just this thing, a superstition. In Dianetics and Scientology, you have innumerable things that are there that you can find. But man's desire to blame it all on something and to get something to take responsibility for it all causes him to look as the Arabs did for demons, devils, spirits, evil geniuses. And where do you go up there? Where's the Arab civilization now, huh? It's under Dull Foster's diplomacy. I can't imagine a more horrible fate. See where it wound up? It's what happens when you start looking for demons and devils and jinns in the wrong places. Now, let's take a good, smooth look at this. And let's understand that if you define a thetan properly, you get a nothingness, which is a somethingness, which looks like a nothingness, and causes the whole thing to go astray. A spirit is something without mass, without wavelength, without actual location, by definition. But it is capable of producing something. It's capable of producing thoughts, mental image pictures, circuits, valences, all under circuits, machinery. It's capable of producing, evidently, anything in the universe. If there isn't anything in the universe it can't produce. So let's start right out with what we have found and what we have detected. Do you know how we know a physical universe is here? And how we know that? We perceive it. So we have the avenues of detection. And this is a whole subject in itself known as percepts. Now, if you list the percepts, you find there are about 53 of them. And these are avenues of detection. But there are other avenues beyond percepts. And these are the avenues of deduction. And there are even further avenues, and these are the avenues of intuition. And then there's the broadest avenue of all. You just decide to know it. never occurred to anybody to stop looking and start knowing. Almost no researcher in the history of the human race has ever done this. To stop looking and start knowing. As long as you're investigating something, you're there, and it's elsewhere. See? You're a here-ness, and it's a there-ness. You're investigating it. Very few people are so ambitious as to simply be it, and thus find out all about it, permeate it. The first ACC, Camden lectures, talk about permeation, ways of knowingness. Amongst the first of these things is simply to know about it. Below that is to have intuitions concerning it. Below that is deduction, to know of its existence by computation, logic, inevitable conclusions, irreducible minimums, that sort of thing. But by and large, because it's part and parcel of communication, percepts occupies our main zone of experience. What we see, feel, hear, and so forth, we conceive to exist. Now, he wasn't the first man, certainly, who ever made a spirit stand up and talk, because that's rather easy to do. You stop somebody on the street and you say, hello, and he says, hello, you've made a spirit stand up and talk. But certainly, any success this has had has depended upon a willingness to know about it, with no great anxiety to know about it. If one had to know about it by perception, fine. If he had to know it by deduction, fine. If he had to know it by intuition, fine. If he had to just know about it by knowing about it, fine. So what, you see? This wasn't a battle engaged in whereby the physical universe was over there and I was over here, all by my little lonesome. You get the idea? There's no sense in that sort of an investigation. If you find anybody in that state, just ask him a few times what he wouldn't mind investigating. His case becomes very ragged at the edges. You walk up to an atomic physicist, a biologist, a chemist, somebody, anybody who is dealing in the sciences, who's looking at bugs through microscopes and so forth. And you get an interesting attitude. This attitude is simply based on he's here and it's there, and he is looking for it or at it. Then you get the mathematician, on the other hand, who does nothing but deduct. A mathematician, if he ever figured anything out by deductions, that's different than income tax deductions. They practically don't exist anymore. He's figuring this thing out by deductions, by logic, by reason. Oh, he's having a wonderful time. The columns of figures are adding up, and the columns of figures are adding up, and he's got more pages and pages and pages, and he goes out and he gets calculating machines, and they all go where, and he gets slide rules, and they go clickety-clack, and he goes over to IBM, and he gets himself a great big thinking calculator, and he figure. He got it all figured out. One day he says, it's obvious. I have the answer. Voila, you see. Or Yavo, whatever nation happens to have spawned him. And he says, scientific findings based on mathematical computations have brought us to the inevitable conclusion that there are no cats. Somebody walks in, and he says, take a look in this basket, Buster. Cat raises his head, looks at the savant, says, meow. The savant says, huh, try to overthrow our logic, will you? Out. There is the door. No matter how much mewing, meowing, letters from the Society for the Protection, Prolongation, Perpetuation of Cats, the scientific world is hanged with the idea that there are no cats. Oh, you just think I'm being very funny, don't you? You think that this is just a gag, don't you? Well, do you know that not too many decades ago, the eighth planet, which was discovered with a telescope, was pronounced not to exist because the computations of a well-known philosopher of the day had deduced that seven was the perfect number. Therefore, there could not be eight planets. And I refer you to this. This is a matter of historical record. Earlier and later, there have been examples of this nonsense. You follow one line only, and you arrive nowhere. He who walks on many roads gets many places. Now, the individual who would find what is must be able to look, deduce, be reasonable, be intuitive, and he must also be capable of knowing, because if he is not basically capable of knowing, he will never recognize the answer when he has it. The broadest superstition which you haven't looked upon too broadly is a superstition. It's a very simple one. It's called germs. Ah, but everybody says you can look through a microscope and you can see them crawling and going this away and that away and so forth. There are many things about germs which are more than view. There's more to know about germs than viewing germs. To freely state that they are living organisms simply because they wiggle-waggle under a microscope, it's not just nonsense, it's merely a certain short-sightedness. Germs do not cause illness. But they certainly appear where illness is. But that they appear where illness is says they accompany illness, and that is the highest conclusion that we can reach with regard to germs. Now, we're not even sure that a fellow who didn't know he was going to get bubonic plague and who was injected with bubonic plague, just bubonic plague germs, we're not at all sure that this individual would get bubonic plague. And even if he did, that proves nothing. Even if we did inject him with bubonic plague and he got bubonic plague, science, you see, science is the religion of today. It is the great high altar from which all knowledge comes. It is the great citadel, the unassaultable fortress, the last answer and the last word. In spite of the fact that science of a physical nature has led the world closer to the brink of destruction than any other line of thought, including early Christianity. And there have been people who, in those days, thought that early Christianity was that activity which was most calculated to destroy Earth. Actually, it first started out destroying the Roman Empire, and it kept right on from there on out. One has lost count of the number of men who have died and the number of governments which have fallen in the name of Christianity. Love thy neighbor even when you're cutting his head off with a sword. But today that's occupied by science. And just as the early Christian was intolerant to a point of madness, this, by the way, was all that was wrong with early Christianity, is it was totally intolerant. It could not be understood by Rome. The Roman, early Roman, didn't understand this religion because he couldn't think of a religion that hated everybody. And I now quote Edward Gibbon, who has a great deal to say on the subject, writing back about 1792. Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire is actually a book about Christianity. And he was just as intolerant as he could be. And the scientist today is no less intolerant. He says, if you can see it with your naked eye, it is. And therefore it causes this and it does that and causes this and it does that. And the significance is this and it causes this. And there we have it. And that is what we have said in our textbook. And if you don't believe it, you're going to flunk and we're not going to get you a job anyplace. And when you go up to get a job with the government and they say, have you got your MA, your PhD, or something else required to become a janitor? They're going to kick you out. They're not going to have anything to do with you. Why? Because you haven't followed this line of logic. Oh, look, why didn't the boy just start in where he started in and stay there and be quiet? He learned how to look. What got him off on a wild tear? Of deducing from lookingness without knowingness. The only thing you could know is what you deduced from lookingness. Oh, no. Let's take a look at that. If everything we deduce from lookingness is true, then every magic show we ever saw is a fact. Isn't that fascinating? Science isn't true. Scientific logic is not faultless. In fact, it looks like Swiss cheese. And sometimes smells like Limburger. You realize the body could react on an obsessive duplication on anything it's afraid of? You can learn that principle if you'd like to look at it and observe and understand it. The body will obsessively duplicate anything it's obsessively afraid of. It's very fascinating. A bullfighter. Have you ever met a bullfighter? Huh? I'm not now talking about a bullfighter. I'm talking about a bullfighter. Why do you suppose he stands in there saying, aha, 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 aha? He's snorting like a bull. You listen to him down in the arena while he's fighting bulls. Aha, aha. He's quite interesting. And after he's fought enough bulls, you look at him in the face, and maybe he looked like an angel when he was first in the arena, but he now looks like a bull. His face has taken on that shape and form. He's duplicating what he is fighting. Get the idea? Quite interesting. It makes one wonder, how many things can a Thetan hate that he becomes that many things? If hate were the total answer, as Pavlov thinks, however, and if there was never any voluntary beingness or any voluntary assumption of form, then it'd be a sorry lot for all of us. Fortunately, there isn't just hate, there isn't just reactive thinking, there isn't just stimulus response, there's also choice, and there's also ability, and there's also desirable beingness. But the fellow who's in there fighting the bull, after a while looks like a bull. And when you shoot the body, which after all is obsessively duplicating and is quite microscopic in its parts, with something that it thinks it has to be the same as, what happens to Pasteur's favorite theory? Now, that theory is that the bugs procreate and procreate and procreate, and as they procreate and procreate and procreate, they go through the body and permeate the body and eat it all up. Here's a principle for you, and one that is much more remarkable than some of those I've been talking about, except the one that's all important. If you look for something, make sure there's something there to find. And we look at this. We see that we've overlooked the possibility that when you show the cells of the body, cell A, where the cells of the body say, oh, I've had it, that's enough, I'm now a bull, and all become cell A. Get the idea? that live cells can become other cells, which they consider overwhelming in their shape and form, has not particularly met with examination in the scientific world. And yet this is quite important, quite important. The progress of a disease, then, would be the progress of body cells betraying and duplicating. It would not be the progress of germs which just went out and chomp, chomp, chomp. You get the idea? And which multiplied and divided and subtracted and were mathematicians in general. You see, this introduces a new factor into all of it. This principle that you should really nail down is that nothing is ever destroyed unless it consents to be destroyed. I call your attention to a hair on your head or your arm. You realize the ease with which a pair of scissors or a knife could cut this hair, right? Great ease. Wouldn't take anything. Supposing the hair had never consented to be cut. And you probably have a much more valid theory of disease inherent right there than any which now exists, because this one works. This one works. Now, you can shoot people with antibiotics, antispiotics. You can mop them up and mope them down. You can put them in hot packs, wet packs, cold packs. You can fix them up, turn them around, circles, spin them, give them electric shocks, and give other humane treatments for this disease or ailment or something of the sort. And they wind up maybe sick. There's no positiveness to it at all. It's sort of something happens here, and we're not quite sure what happens. But the positive cure of disease is beyond the power of man pre-Dianetics. The actual cure of disease, this we can demonstrate conclusively. We're not now in a field of figure-figure and non-demonstration and non-perception, non-knowingness. We can demonstrate this. It was incurable. I'll give you some idea. They go around scratching people for smallpox, and they've cut the smallpox down in the world most amazingly. I am very sure they've cut it down to the degree they've made people believe they wouldn't get smallpox or something of the sort. But do you know that the first 100 soldiers admitted into military hospitals with smallpox in World War II had each one of them been vaccinated properly and in the proper period of time to be immune? The first 100 soldiers admitted into military hospitals all been properly vaccinated, and they all had smallpox. You see, science has a habit of saying, that is the answer. And after that, instead of being reasonable about it, to point their professorial pens, to point their lecture guns, their grade systems, straight at the individual and say, now don't think about it anymore. Don't examine it again. Don't look it over. Because we've said so. Get the idea? And all you have to do is go around and take some of the favorite theories held by these people, like vaccination. Just take this favorite theory and now go out and actually look and know and deduce and have intuitions about it and finally come up with an answer everybody can agree with. And the answer that everybody can agree with is that vaccination has very little to do with the situation. Now, it's very true that those American soldiers who had had typhus shots when they were put in prison camps in Europe, did not in any large proportion get typhus. And with great glee, we see all medical science making a great deal out of this, saying, look, 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 look how effective our typhus shots are. Let me point out something else to you. There's very little typhus in the United States. These soldiers just happen to be possibly a strain of people that don't get typhus easily. See? You see how smelly the scientific logic is if you once hold it up. So cover it up quickly and put it away if it begins to smell like Limburger, and go on your own ability to know thereafter. You got it? If it's something doesn't stand up to your observation, and if you cannot agree with the thing, you get another condition which is quite important to you in research and detection. And that is, if you can't agree that that is a fact, if your knowingness does not add up to knowingness after you have intuitivated and deductivated and looked and inspected and crept around it and sniffed at it and patted it on the head and so forth, and you still don't know what that is all about, then you'd better reject it. You'd better reject it. Either decide you're looking for something that doesn't exist, or that you aren't looking for it in the right way, or decide something else. Rather, I must go on looking for this, and certainly never decide this. I must believe it because somebody said it was true. Oh, all the gravestones in the universe were erected upon that mound, and every one carries the legend, I must believe it because another said it was true. Fascinating. When you have injured the ability of man to inspect, you have hurt his ability to live. He must be capable of inspecting. He must be able to get at the evidence. If he cannot do so, you have a slave society, and you don't want one of those. Slaves are no good to anybody, least of all to their masters. The entirety of man's history has been a search to know any of his written history. And when you're doing engram detection, you're engaging on a parallel of a search to know. And this search to know is terribly important to you. But it must be conducted, not because I said it was true. Do you understand that? It must be conducted flexibly. It must be conducted with participation on your part. You mustn't believe that because I tell you they are, then they are, and you don't look at it any further. The way to enter this thing is to first recognize that you are detecting something when somebody's conduct, no matter his willingness, is apparently out of his own control. When he trips across a chalk line, when he falls on the orchestra conductor's head, you say, well, now, wait a minute. When this individual is professing to be a cook and burns all the eggs, you look it over and you say, what is all this? Why can't this man take a positive action? Why can't this girl act in an orderly way? Why can't we sort this thing out properly? Well, that's your first detection. And if you have detected that in man, you have started on the road to the detection of engrams. If there was something inexplicable, as far as you were concerned, about his activities, reactions, his conduct, and if you, in talking to him, have found out that he himself often tries to do something and apparently intends to make a go of something and yet is unable to because something is holding him back, and if you've made that observation of man, you have started well on the road of detection of engrams. And when you've taken your fingers and snapped it in front of somebody's face and you ask him something about times and dates, you're well advanced. Even before that time, you should ask people if they can see pictures or black fields or if they see anything when they shut their eyes. Do mental image pictures exist? Do occlusions exist? Do occlusions finally open out and become pictures? Do invisible fields suddenly condense into pictures on people who tell you very sniffishly, pictures, pictures, I never have any pictures. Only morons and children get pictures. And you say, well, what can you confront, Buster? What can you confront, pal? Thank you, what can you confront? Yeek! Scream. And is he looking at a picture? Now, that's your criteria. Can he see one? Well, now, don't just believe him. Go around and ask some other people.
You ever see picture?
Well, picture, picture. What do you say? Close your eyes. What are you looking at? Well, picture, picture. I don't see anything. What? Oh, nothing here but this picture of my mother with a milk bottle in her hand and a nappy. Always have that. Never noticed before it was there, but I always have it. You go around and you ask some of these people, and you ask them if they see these pictures. Well, you better find out if anybody ever gets any pains from these pictures. If you move a picture, does somebody hurt? Got the idea? You move a picture, does somebody get a headache? Does he get upset? Does he get sick in his stomach or something like that? You start moving pictures around. Does something occur? All right. Does somebody respond when you say, you walk up to this elderly man? You say, how old are you? And he says, well, let's see. Now, I'm just a son. The first day was all left track of that. And I had my last birthday about 10, 15 years ago. And that would be right after, no, let's see. I think that was before Aunt Agatha died. And, you tired of listening to this balderdash? Say an age will flash when I snap my fingers. And you say, and he says, the number 3 occurs to me. Now, just what causes this thing to flash? It's an interesting thing. What's he stuck in? What prompts him to give such a reaction? Well, you put him on an e-meter. You start calling off dates and times. You just decide to go back year by year. Anything bad happened this year? Anything bad happened last year? Anything bad happened the year before? All of a sudden, you get a dip on the needle. It dives a little bit. So you say, well, what happened in that year? No, it's nothing very much. I was operated on for gallbladder, had 3-4 teeth extracted, was in an automobile accident, my wife died. You say, well, which one of these seemed to upset you the most? Well, the one I care least about was the automobile accident. You say, how about your wife's death? Nothing happens very much. You say, well, how about the extractions? Well, nothing happens very much. Well, how about the teeth? Did they hurt? And they come out? No, nothing very happens very much. How about the gallbladder? Nothing very much happens there. That automobile accident. Down goes that needle. You say, close your eyes. What part of an automobile could you confront? And there's the automobile parked up against the tree. He sees it. He reacts to it. He's quite alert to it. He tells you about it. It's a picture, isn't it? Well, you're getting along the line here now. You're looking for something. It's easy to look for because the route has been well blazed. Got road markers and signs every place. As a matter of fact, in some place, you can't get through because of the signs. It's just closed off. I'm trying to open the road up right now. So we look along this track. We are brought to conclude something. That there are pictures and that we are looking for something that is there. See? That's a happy thought. That's a happy frame of mind to be in. And until you're in that frame of mind, brother, you can't run an engram. You won't have a prayer running an engram, let me tell you, because you'll be running a non-existence. And you'll be looking for something that is hidden that to you isn't there. And the next thing you know, you will be going this way and that way and around the block and so forth and saying, well, it's concept, it's thought, it's this, it's that, or circles or diagrams. And I better get out my magic pentagon and have the spirit osmosis appear therein at my command, you know, because that's going to work better. You get the idea? You see, if you go on looking for something that isn't there, that you can't find at least, well, you're certainly never going to do anything with it. Now, let's just think about that for a minute. If you go around playing with marbles which don't exist, you're not going to win many marbles or marble games or anything else, are you? The first condition of a game of marbles is the existence of marbles. And perhaps having your particular quota of marbles helps. But in this particular game of looking for the mental image picture, you have only decided so far, as I have outlined it, that these things exist, right? You've just gone along that far. These things exist. Now, it'll take you actually weeks of experience to find out what they can do. Existence is one thing. How about the capabilities of these things? Ooh, this is another subject entirely. You see, this individual is very prone to colds. He coughs. He has stomach aches. He gets upsets. He goes into all sorts of thingamabobs and whatnots every time somebody says snaffles for some reason or other. All he's got to do is read snaffles or hear snaffles, and he starts to wheeze and snort and have an awful time. That's all. He's gone. So you run some engrams on him, and after a while you can say snaffles, and he says waffles. So what? See? Did the eradication of the picture or the increase of the person to a higher ability to confront remove an aberrated condition? And after you've run a great many engrams on a person and run them well, remember, everybody was looking at engrams at first. It was wonderful. The University of Chicago, by the way, conducted a test in class one time on engrams and then adventurously released a paper. And they pretend to be great scientific agencies of one kind or another. So they said, we took some psychologists and we gave them the book, and they've read some of this thing called Dianetics, and then they practiced on several people, and this is the total scientific report I'm giving you, see? They told how many people, that sort of thing, but then they said, there is nothing to the claim that mental image pictures do anything to anybody. Oh, boy, that was real rough. That was real rough. The Dianeticist that went over to see the guy that wrote and released the paper later wrote me a very gleeful letter about the whole thing. He said he was stuck in birth, and when I left him, his nose was running, and he was screaming at the top of his voice. I guess that fellow didn't want to confront any pictures, huh? Now, when you look over the whole field of pictures, you have several things to decide, and I've given them to you in this talk. They're things that you have to decide for yourself, you see. The amount of drama in handling pictures is tremendous. But you won't get any drama if your auditing skill isn't good. So part of the search for pictures is superb auditing skill. Just searching for them. You can't loosely search for them and not be a good auditor. You won't find them. You won't find them at all. And it isn't that you get any magic finger just by knowing how to ask people questions. But you have to ask them questions. You have to be able to walk up to somebody and say, close your eyes. What are you looking at? The fellow says, nothing. Come on, what are you looking at? He says, nothing. He says, nothing but this nothingness in front of me. And you said, well, are you looking at nothingness? Well, yeah, that's right. I've always been, well, what do you know? I've always been looking at nothing except for this small boat. Well, where did that come from? And you know, people, particularly research people that are dedicated to mathematics and that sort of thing, research people very, very, very often don't have the ability to confront another human being, so they can't ask them questions. And you need just that much auditing skill in order to find out anything about these things at all, don't you see? You can't turn it over to some university that doodle-daddles around, does it on a slide rule, has said it has nothing to do with human beings, but applies mostly to mice. You can't do that sort of thing. You've got to look. A book isn't going to look for you. A set of statistics aren't going to look for you. And the only thing I can tell you, actually, is how to look and deduce and know about these things. All I can tell you is how to look, how to find them. If I came along and told you, you know, there's a pot of gold out here on Chumley Road. And we're just telling you that's on Chumley Road, you see, is sufficient to give you some direction. Now, that isn't evaluating for you. You can go out to Chumley Road and look around. You can come back and you can say, Ron, we've been out to Chumley Road. Well, we don't find any gold out there. Well, I say, where'd you go? Oh, he just went out and got off the bus there at the bus stop and looked around on the sidewalk, and there wasn't any gold there. Well, I would have been guilty then of giving you less than explicit directions, right? See, but if I said, now it's 132 Chumley Road, and you go back through the hall, you go down a flight of stairs into the basement. You go to the back of the basement. There's a large block of stone there. You pull a large block of stone out. You look inside. There's a whole big pot of gold. Told you this. You see? And what do you do? Well, you go out there and you look. You pull down the stone and you look, and there's a block of gold. That's it. You see? So those directions were correct, right? Now, all I have done is simply to have been there and looked. But in order to get there, I had to walk along certain roads and arrive at a certain place. And then I had to remember where I'd been and come back. An awful lot of people start on this search and never come back, you know. That's right. There's even a technical term for it in Scientology. It's called going up the pole. Man, you start going up the pole, you'll see somebody around. He'll start telling you theories and knowing this and so forth. What he's gotten is almost instantaneous increase to total knowingness, and it utterly throws him. He hasn't the stability to contain it or examine it or anything else, and he simply ecstaticates thereafter. Sometimes it lasts for 3 days, sometimes 5 days, and sometimes 6 or 8 months. It's not necessarily bad. It's not necessarily bad. It's awfully hard to live with, however. He's gone over and left perception and any gradient scales and roadways, and he's done a sudden jump into what we used to call bin 3. And he'd had it. You had no way to follow him over to bin 3. He didn't tell you where he got through the boards. See, he didn't give you a clue. And there's many a prophet done this. It's very spectacular, you know, but it generally winds up in slaughter. A lot of people go out and try to find bin 3, wind up in the Huskal, Valhalla, amongst 40 dark-eyed Uris or something. Lord knows where they're trying to get to, but they don't wind up in bin 3. So you could say that many, many philosophers have been engaged in a game of getting everyone lost. I've considered it a peculiar responsibility, one, not to get people lost, and two, not to get lost myself. I thought that would be an optimum solution to it. Therefore, all that has been plotted here is a track along which you can look and routes you can take to see something. Now, I could say the routes aren't important, and not is it, you know, and be in a high state of Anglo-American coyness about the whole thing. But personally, I think it's a pretty good plotted route myself. I think it was pretty well laid out, and I don't think it was nothing, because certainly it was never done before, you see. And it seems to be an awfully simple short look. You know, it's an awfully simple look. And I suppose anybody, whoever did it before, thought, well, if I gave that away and so forth, well, then everybody'd know, and the game would be gone, and that would be a terrible circumstance, and they wouldn't think I was a great man or something. So after you've found these, and after you've gotten the experience of it, and after you've discovered that they can be erased and reduced and handled in various fashions, then let me assure you of one thing. A demonstration of your ability to walk this road, and a demonstration of your ability to reduce these things, and a demonstration of your ability to then know about and handle the behavior of man, leaves you without any further responsibility as far as following the road I gave you. You understand that? You don't have to go on following this road. Wander around all over the place if you want to. Perfectly all right with me. But if you tell other people that you're going to find these things for them, there's only one injunction which is laid upon you. If you're going to find these things in other people for them and to help them, then you had better follow an agreed-upon road which they can follow too. And if you do that, we'll all be happy. Now, we have opened the gates to a wide and broad freedom that man has never before been permitted to look on. It's not a small thing that's happened here. But nothing is going to happen at all unless you follow this road and look and satisfy yourselves as to the existence of these things and the results which accrue in their removal. Thank you.